Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have a great show for you today. My guest will be Dr. Charles Plackin. He is the director of the New York City Food Policy Center and founder of thedietdetective.com. And he'll be on in just a little bit. But first, I want to just talk to you about some things going on in and around the news, and of course share my weekly recipe with you. So, of course, the main news that we're hearing every single day, all day long, is about our president-elect and the wonderful cabinet that he has decided to surround himself with. And it is scary, and it is upsetting, and you know, and it's hard to imagine how the next 4 years are going to go. And yet, I want to share with you this one piece that has come out that has given me a little bit hope, and it's an indivisible guide. And I actually sent a, you know, shared a link with it on my website. But if you go to, you know, just Google the indivisible guide, and it's a guidebook to really show us how we can fight back, starting small increments, but working together. And it's modeled, believe it or not, after the Tea Party, you know, having watched how they grew from non-existence to really taking back the Congress. It is a model for replicating, and it starts small and it starts local, and it requires people to not let up and to just give in and show up everywhere. And that's what, you know, I'm calling on all of my listeners and followers to do, is to just, you know, take action. When you see an opportunity to call your senator or representative, do it. When you see an opportunity to show up at someone's office or on the street somewhere with signs, do it. We all have to really get out there in whatever our way is. You know, everyone can't do the same thing. There's so many different issues. You know, everyone has to pick their issue, but then pick it and stick with it and, you know, make a commitment in this new year to become an active citizen and to, you know, really hold dear the things that you value and to be willing to stand up and show up where we need to. And, you know, and if we all do that, and really all do that in 2 years when a lot of our representatives and senators are up for renewal, we can, you know, start making a change there, and then hopefully in 4 years change things around. But meanwhile, it's just unbelievable, and for me, infuriating listening to the news in the morning. I wake up to NPR, and it's just like, oh, my God, I don't know where to start. So anyway, we all just have to start small, and I have petitions on my website that you can always sign. Right now, there's one up there to tell Congress to pass Elizabeth Warren's Presidential Conflicts of Interest Act without delay. I mean, you know, President-elect has so many foreign contracts and influences that we don't even know about, and he's yet to release his tax returns, which might give us some insight to some of those things. But he's also, you know, not divesting from his companies. He's, you know, going to pass on responsibility to his sons, but meanwhile he's going to keep his interest in it, which will affect how he runs our country. And so we really need to sign this petition and try to prevent that from happening. Also, we want to do whatever we can to protect health care for so many people. Yes, we all agree that the insurance companies are, you know, overcharging and it's too expensive, but we can't just go in and rip it all out and take health insurance away from 20 million Americans who are depending on it. So, you know, keep watching that. Also in the news a lot, there's discussion continuously about vertical farming, hydroponics, all versus organic farming, and whether something grown hydroponically without spray or pesticides, can that be considered organic? And, you know, and that's a debate that's going on, and it's interesting to watch it play out. But, you know, this article that I wrote about on vertical farming, you know, we certainly can agree that vertical farming, hydroponic farming, it's certainly better than conventional agriculture that's going on right now, where we're spraying the pesticides and herbicides and using synthetic fertilizers, etc. So if this is a way that it can help feed people that otherwise don't have access to food, it's certainly a better solution. And what we really have to work on is finding the common ground that we can agree on, which is, you know, fighting chemical poisons in farm and food systems globally. We need to all support family farms and farm workers globally that are practicing sustainability, environmental stewardship, and social justice. And we can all agree that we want to eliminate food deserts in our poorest communities and help to give food access to people who need it. So those are things that we can really agree on. So let's work on where we can agree and try to work together, because it just doesn't make sense for organic farmers and people who are growing hydroponically in an organic, sustainable method. There's still, everyone's trying to do a good thing. So let's focus on the things that we really can agree on and move forward, because we just need to find those common grounds and work together. So I want to share this recipe with you. They came out great. I had this winter squash that was sitting here, kombucha squash that I grew. And so this recipe actually only used half of the squash. But if you're using a butternut squash or an acorn squash, which are a little smaller, you might use the whole thing. So I actually measured out how much of the squash I used, which was 2 cups. So you can, you know, whatever squash you end up using in this recipe, you'll roast it and measure out 2 cups. So they're winter squash croquettes with tofu and quinoa. They came out really good. And one of the things that I always complain about when I get veggie burgers is very often they're mushy. They don't have the texture that you want. And when you do find the texture you want, usually it's with some sort of TVP or something that you don't really want to be eating. But these really held up great. I used quinoa in them, and quinoa was a little bit, you know, soft. I cook it in not as much water as one sometimes does, so the quinoa was not mushy at all. And they came out just wonderful. So this is it. I'm going to use olive oil for some sautéing, 2 cups of roasted winter squash. So you can do that. What I did for roasting the squash was, you know, 375-degree oven or 400-degree oven, cut the squash in half, take the seeds out, and just roast it until it's soft. And, of course, it depends on the size of your squash, depends on how long it takes. Mine took about 40 minutes. 1 onion chopped, 3 carrots chopped fine, 10 cloves of garlic chopped fine, 2 stalks of celery chopped fine, 2 cups of chopped broccoli, also cut fine, 1 cup of quinoa, and like I said, I cooked it with only 1.5 cups of water instead of 2, and I cooked it for about 15 minutes, so all the water absorbed, and even some of the quinoa on the bottom got a little crispy, and it was really great. 1 cake of extra firm tofu, and I use the sprouted tofu. It's a 20-ounce cake, and it's really firm, but you can use, you know, any extra firm tofu between 16 and 20 ounces and press the water out before crumbling it. 1/4 cup of fresh chopped dill, 1/4 cup of fresh thyme, 1/4 cup of parsley. If you don't have fresh dill or thyme, you can use a teaspoon of dried thyme, 1 tablespoon of fresh rosemary that I also pulsed in a little mini food processor so that it was fine, 10 sage leaves that I chopped up, 2 tablespoons of tamari, 2 tablespoons of aji marine, which is a sweet rice wine. I'm going to mention this again because I've mentioned it before, but Kikkoman brand, they put out a soy sauce that's not very good. They also put out an aji marine that's not really aji marine. Aji marine is sweet rice wine, and it has some seaweed in it, and that's all it is. If you look at the back of a Kikkoman bottle that says aji marine, it's glucose water or glucose syrup and corn syrup. It is not mirin. So please don't buy the Kikkoman brand. If you go to Whole Foods, please complain and tell them that they shouldn't be carrying that at all. I've done it, and it's still on the shelf and infuriates me. Okay, a quarter cup of fresh chopped parsley. I already said that. A half a teaspoon of salt, a half a teaspoon of pepper, a quarter cup of nutritional yeast. And then after I made the patties, I breaded them in a cup of organic cornflakes, a cup of tortilla chips, and a quarter cup of chopped chives. And I didn't use all of the cornflakes or the tortilla chips that I ground up, so I have some extra for the last time. So you maybe even could do a half a cup of cornflakes and a half a cup of tortilla chips, and that would work fine. And so you're going to saute the onions in olive oil until they're translucent. Then you're going to add the carrots, the celery, and the chopped garlic, and continue cooking until those are soft. Add the mirin and the tamari and cook for about 5 more minutes. Add the broccoli and all of the herbs and continue cooking for another 5 minutes or so. In a food processor, pulse the tofu until it's really crumbly. Add that to the vegetables. Continue cooking for another 10 minutes or so until all of the moisture has evaporated. Then add the 2 cups of the roasted squash to the pan and mix it well, along with the quinoa. Add the salt, pepper, nutritional yeast to that, and just mix it all up. And between the squash and the quinoa, all of the vegetables stick together. You don't need any eggs. You don't need any flour. It just sticks together perfectly. And so just make them into patties and bread them in the cornflakes, the tortilla chips, and the chives. So it makes a nice little coating, and it adds crispness to the patties. And I baked them. I didn't want to fry them, so I just put them on a cookie sheet with parchment paper. I did spray the parchment paper with a little olive oil and made the patties, and I actually sprayed the top of the patties with a little bit of olive oil. Just a little spray so that I wasn't using a lot of oil, but it helped crispen it up. And I cooked it at 375 for 15 minutes, pulled it out, turned them over, and cooked it for another 10 minutes. And they were really crispy on the outside, great texture, great flavor. You can either serve them on, small slider buns if you wanted, or you can just serve them by themselves. I made a little dipping sauce with some vegan mayo, a little bit of ketchup, some good jalapeno sauce, so it was spicy, some red peppers, came out great. But you can really do it, whatever flavor you want. It's also great with mustard, sauerkraut. It's great. So have fun with it and let me know how you liked it. And now it's my pleasure to introduce to all of you Dr. Charles Plackin. As I said, he is the director of the New York City Food Policy Center at Hunter College. He is also one of the country's leading nutrition and public health advocates. He has a syndicated health, nutrition, and fitness column called The Diet Detective, which appears in more than 100 daily newspapers and media outlets. And his website, thedietdetective.com, offers more than 500 articles and interviews on nutrition, food, and fitness. I went looking at some of the people he interviewed, and all top hitters, really great. So check those out. Dr. Plackin is also a distinguished lecturer at Hunter College. And so, Dr. Plackin, are you there?
I'm here. Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you? Thanks for joining us this
morning.
I'm
great. Thanks. Do you hear me okay?
I can hear you fine, thank you.
That's great.
So, I wanted to just start to find out a little bit of history about you. You have your finger on the pulse of so many different things. When did you first get interested in food and food policy and health technology?
Well, it really started a long time ago, probably I would say close to 20-some-odd years ago, when my father was diagnosed with diabetes. It was just something, no one had ever been in the hospital before, no one had any issues of health before, and then all of a sudden, we hear this, my father has diabetes. It was earth-shattering in my family. And so it really motivated me to start thinking about food, the foods that I eat. I'd always been overweight or obese as a child, and I saw, my uncle had diabetes, my grandfather had diabetes, and they all, they passed. And it was not pretty. And I thought, oh my gosh, I don't want to go in that direction. What can I do? And that's when I started thinking about food in a different way. Cut to 25, 30 years later, now his leg's amputated and he's not doing well. And, you know, diabetes is a horrific disease. And it really is what drove me and motivated me to be in this space. And, you know, certainly I evolved in this space over time, but that was really that was the trigger moment for me.
Uh-huh. And so did you study become a nutritionist or a dietitian? What was your educational background for this?
It sounds a little convoluted, but first I actually went to law school because I wanted to be a district attorney. So I went to law school and I graduated and I thought, oh, I don't think this is what I want to do with my life. And I started getting involved with media and, it was a pretty circuitous route and then eventually got involved with media and health. And realized that was something that was, you know, important to me. And then I wrote my first book, which was called Breaking the Pattern, and that was very successful. And then I got a book offer from Penguin, and it was a really amazing thing. I didn't even think I could write, and here I am now, going to be, have my second book published by a major publisher. And I thought, I need to get a degree, because having a law degree sounds really weird and so unrelated to health. And they agreed. They said, we want to develop you as an author. So I went and got my master's in public health. And interestingly enough, I finally, it took a year and a half in the book, publishing business is a very long, you submit a manuscript, it doesn't get published for a year to a year and a half, even in today's day. There's long lead times. So I finally finished my degree. They're designing the jacket, the book's done, and I say, oh, I have my MPH now, not just a law degree. And they basically, after a year and a half of studying, going to school, and they say, oh, that's great. We don't really know what that is, so thank you, but we're just going to keep it without any initials. But at that point, I already had fallen in love with the concept of public health and nutrition, and I stayed in school and continued and went on and got my PhD in public health and nutrition.
Yeah, it's funny, so often what we start out doing is not what we end up doing. And I talk to lots of young people who are, went to school for one thing, but that's not feeling quite right. And it's like, it is just a process. But if you follow what you really love, you end up in the right spot,
Yeah, I think it's really important to really believe in the things that you're doing. And to, I know people hear that. And they, yeah, and so forth. And it goes in one ear, sometimes out the other. But I think that if you do really try to pursue and you take the risks, especially when you're young, to think about, how can I, what is it that I really want to do? An experiment. And, and learn some of the more important life skills, like being on time and being a good listener and, being compassionate and being understanding, trying to, work things out and sort of realize that you're not the only person in the world. I think some of those key points really help to go much further than people think.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Now, as director of the New York City Food Policy Center at 100, did you start the Food Policy Center there? I was trying to find the history of that, and I couldn't. When did that start?
We erased the history. I'm teasing. What happened was Nick Freudenberg, who is no longer at Hunter, but now at the CUNY School of Public Health, he and I and Neil Cohn, who is a former health commissioner in New York City, and Jennifer Rapp, who's the president of Hunter College, went to Chris Quinn, who was a speaker at the time of the city council, and in New York City, and asked and said, this is an idea that we have of a center, an academic center that focuses around food policy, but looks at food policy in a very broad way, and would really sort of be an outside academic party that we'd be a partner to the city and all the community-based organizations and academicians focusing on this space. And that was really the birth of the center. And we started something called the Food Policy Watch, which was a monthly newsletter and now is weekly and has become a digest. And we're incredibly proud of it. And a lot of hours and time goes into combing through all the stories that are related to food policy. And we have a subscription list of, I think it's nearly 4,500 people right now that are all in the New York and in food policy around the country and in the world, that are reading it, religiously each week and looking for how we call together the digest of food policy related stories and journals. And we also produce, 4 to 5, 3 to 5 stories each week, that we pay freelancers for or do internally, and, try to create awareness around these issues that sometimes people don't have the time, effort, or energy to think about it in a cerebral way that we're doing it. So that's just, one of the things that was born out of in those beginning times and has really moved in such a great, wonderful, positive direction. The other is we have breakfast events. We call them Food Policy for Breakfast. And those have been incredibly, widely attended. And the audience is made up of social entrepreneurs focusing on the food community, academics, as well as students who happen to be required to go, especially my students, and as well as government work, government staff from the health department, both New York and New York State, New York City, and other community-based organization leaders and people that work in that space. And those events we do about 15 a year, and they're free, always free to the public. We promote them on our newsletter and they're widely attended. Like I said, I think we get between 100 and 150 people at each event.
I've gone to many and they are wonderful. And,
and
I also get your weekly digest and it's great. So thank you for that work. It's wonderful. Now the Food Policy Center is different than the New York City Food Policy Council, correct?
That is correct. Yes. Yes.
Right.
We're funded by the City Council of New York, as well as some other funding that we receive, and we are also funded by Hunter College, where we get a lot of in-kind, all of our space and support and everything else comes from Hunter College.
Mm-hmm.
And we're a Hunter College center.
Right. Right.
Jennifer Rapp, and the president of Hunter, has been a very tremendous supporter of food policy and really sees the importance of it in the community. So she's been wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is. And, and the fact that you make it accessible to everybody without charge and also offer a breakfast that is actually, you have some healthy options there, which is nice. It always cracks me up, or doesn't crack me up, but I always find it interesting when you go to these health conferences and they have the same food that you'd find at anything else, just bagels and white bagels and cream cheese, and that's Danish.
And you will absolutely positively not find that at the breakfast. I refuse to have muffins.
Right.
And Alexina Cather, who's the deputy director, is been ribbing me about that. We need to have organic. Now we have to take it even a higher level. And I said, well, we need to get more funding if we're going to be able to do that. But at least I have oatmeal and a lot of fresh fruit and water, albeit it's in plastic containers, embarrassingly enough. But, we have coffee and things of that sort. So I think that we're trying to take it from there. There will be zero muffin. We have a zero muffin policy at our food policy for breakfast seminars.
That's good.
There was a time we weren't serving any breakfast. So now at least we have breakfast. So you can come there and eat for free.
That's definitely a draw for some people, for sure. And I think if we publicize it even more to some of the communities that don't have good food, we might get some more people there, too, and influence them.
That's correct, yes.
Yeah, we need to spread the message. Right now, food issues, food policy, food sustainability, they've become, certainly sexy topics, and they're, things that lots of young people with their altruistic beliefs and their wonderful energy, they want to go to school for this, and there's so many choices now, and there's also a lot of online courses and degrees that I'm seeing. How does one sift through them to find what's good and quality out there, and also is there enough work for people in these areas? I know people are always asking me that, and I'm not really sure.
Well, I mean, I think you have to distinguish between working in the food service industry, working in nutrition education for community-based organizations, or working for food policy related organizations, like, let's say, City Harvest, which might be, you know, food policy and emergency food organization, because they're not just about, you know, picking up fruits and vegetables and redistributing. They're a big organization. And I think that there are jobs out there. They're not a lot of them, but for highly qualified people that don't want to make a lot of money, there are certainly jobs out there. In terms of restaurant jobs and culinary jobs, there are a lot of jobs. This city is a eating city, and you know, I think that the movement towards good food jobs has been one that's been wonderful, and I think that it's nice. And having owned, it's part of my bio that may not be in there, but I've owned three restaurants, and you know, I think that you know, your staff and them being happy are critical. You wouldn't know that when I was running the restaurant, because I was also, you know, 22 years old and didn't know anything. So, but today, if I owned a restaurant, I think I'd have a completely different approach. And I think that some of the more progressive, more the smarter and more capable restaurateurs are really focusing on those kinds of things to make sure that they can deliver even better, higher quality food, deliver better, happier workers that are more stable, and those kinds of things. I think around jobs are important. And in terms of studying for those, you know, again, it's, I think, you know, taking the time to sit in on classes, which most professionals would allow you to do, really going in and meeting and doing your homework, you know, going online, listening, going in and sort of listening to what people are saying on social media about different programs. And I think that one of the things that happens is, you know, that we tend to get lazy and we allow things to take place for us instead of us making the way that we want them to go. So, you know, doing the legwork and, you know, really thinking through what you want to do and how you want to do it. If you're not sure, try experimentation, right? I mean, you know, go online, look here, you know, take a class. In fact, you know, I would recommend for somebody that wants to get into this area, this, you know, in food policy, culinary, there are so many free classes that you can audit online that are phenomenal at from some of the top universities in the world, like Corsia and John Hopkins and so forth, and they're free, absolutely free. Now, if you want credit for them, then you have to pay, but they're free to audit. So right. I suggest that, you know, really go out there and look online, you know, and become a master of that.
Mm-hmm. Going back to the Food Policy Center at Hunter, what are some of your main missions there? Like, do you have certain areas that you focus on more than others?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. I think, you know, one of the things that the deputy director and I have been focusing on is looking at, well, you know, there are a lot of organizations out there that are trying to help, right, which I think is wonderful. However, you know, I think it's also important to take a step back and, you know, sort of widen your lens and look a little bit differently and see how you can create different approaches to problems that have been in existence for quite some time, like food insecurity, food safety, food waste, you know, and food-related chronic diseases, and think, okay, well, what is it that we can do here that's different than what everybody else is doing? Yes, I think community-based organizations, you know, are wonderful and they need help and support and everything else, but what can we do? What are areas that we are familiar with? And one of the spaces that I'm very interested in is health technology, because I think that if you hit something right, it could save and influence so many lives so well. And I'll give you a non-food related example. There's something called a Life Straw. I don't know if you've ever heard of it, but it's very simple, and it's I think that they're 99 cents or a dollar. And basically, with this straw, you can, you know, go into, if you're in a country, an impoverished country, and the water is not safe, you can use this Life Straw to eat, you know, to sort of drink the water there, which is so highly, you know, toxic in many places. But with this Life Straw, you can drink the water. So, I mean, this has saved so many lives, you know, around the world, and it's a for-profit company, And, you know, those, just that one, that one life straw has been, and it's very inexpensive, is a, you know, huge advancement, you know, and has solved so many problems in so many countries around the world and for so many people. So thinking along those lines, thinking about, okay, well, what can we do and how can we do things differently? And it's so easy when you're working so hard every day to just get the things you're already doing done, to try to think outside the box and think of innovation and creativity. So we're looking at technology and thinking about, okay, how can community-based organizations think differently, right? And so we're one of the first things we have we're working on is our, we're a series of reports on food innovation, technology, and food systems. And so the first one that's coming out, I think, probably in a week, if we could ever get the design right, we will release it. It's about 100 pages. And it's all about different things that are going on technologically in applications, in online food delivery. I'm sure you're aware that recently, in the last 5 or 6 days, the USDA has agreed to do, I think, a 10-state pilot for people to accept for these online delivery services like Amazon Fresh and Fresh Direct to deliver foods if you have, you know, a snack card, which before you were not able to do that. And actually on nycfoodpolicy.org, we have a great article that we spent a lot of time working on to try to get people to be able to understand what it is with SNAP and accepting SNAP cards and what the problems were and the experiments that were done in the past in the Bronx with Fresh Direct, which we believe were not successful. That's, you know, my personal opinion, and why they weren't successful and what needs to happen along with these online delivery services for them to sort of impact. And think about this really carefully, about impacting, you know, there's a whole discussion and movement around healthy food access, right? So, mm-hmm. you know, and building infrastructure and supermarkets and how expensive that is. And the margins are so slim, meaning, you know, it's so hard for supermarkets to make money, right? And so the idea of being able to have an online delivery service, be able to fill that gap with no infrastructure costs, and being able to go into a community where people, you know, where someone might have, you know, two jobs or, you know, have children and not have child support or care, and have to leave them to go to the supermarket, or they're working all day and they're tired, and to have your food delivery waiting for you so that you can eat, you know, healthy, fresh, you know, produce and so forth. That is a bit, that can be a big deal, right? I'm not saying it is definitely going to work, but it's an opportunity to look at something differently. And that's what I, you know, before I was talking about looking at something with different optics. That's an example, an exact example of looking at it differently. Here we're so focused on, we've got to get more supermarkets, we've got to get more supermarkets. And here there's all these delivery services that the affluent are using, you know, very successfully. You know, you sort of have your phone, you put your order in, and the food just comes. You know, and so now to have that, you know, underserved communities be able to have access to that, that maybe a supermarket doesn't want to go into because there's not enough traffic, or, you know, not enough whatever it is, or the rents are too high because of gentrification. That's innovation. That's thinking outside the box. Now, is it going to work immediately? Probably not, because there's a lot of other things that need to go along with it.
Mm-hmm. Now, this 10-state pilot, this is for SNAP recipients?
This is for SNAP recipients to be able to use certain online delivery food services, yes. And again, if you go to nycfoodpolicy.org, there's we have an article right on the front page, which talks about it in great detail.
Mm-hmm. And yet the people do get to pick what they want delivered, or is it pre-decided for them?
No, they do have choices, and there are restrictions though. Mm-hmm. There are still SNAP restrictions.
Right. Okay. So the same restrictions apply.
Yeah.
Uh huh. Are they including any type of recipes or no? I guess not, because it's all different foods. So there's not any standard.
Well, and that's one of the. And that's a great point. I think that, you know, I think one of the reasons why these have not been as successful, one is price. Some of these delivery services are higher priced in some instances than the regular supermarket. Another is because there needs to be, you know, culturally, it takes a long time for people to be willing to get their produce and, you know, instead of hand-picking it and, you know, touching it and feeling it, just delivered to them, right? So you have to develop a level of trust. So these organizations, if they want to be successful in these areas, will have to do a lot of outreach. And part of that outreach should be nutrition education and so forth. And I think that that's where, like a New York City Food Policy Center at Hunter College can come in and work with some of these organizations like Amazon Fresh and Fresh Direct to help guide them so that they can go into these communities and look at them and as profit centers using SNAP and also combine it with things that would be phenomenal, like nutrition education and being able to make sure that they feel secure about buying produce online, how to do it, how to to use the technology on their phone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, I didn't read your book, Breaking the Pattern, but I would just think, you know, having done enough of my, you know, being in this field for so long, so much of the problems in the lower income communities are patterns and, food choices that are just ingrained in their food. I mean, you can just see when you go into neighborhoods where, you know, it's just blanketed with fast food stores and restaurants and, you know, trying to get people to change the foods that they crave is really, really, I think, at the crux of so much of the obesity and diabetes problem is just getting people to be willing to try different foods and eat different foods. I know, I sometimes go and cook at farmers markets in underprivileged areas, and I try to make foods that are typical for that community, let's say like a jambalaya or some Cajun food or spicy food or food that they can relate to that will be completely vegan. And I know people are blown away actually when they eat it because they really didn't think, really, there's no meat in here, really, there's no nothing bad in here. And the kids come by, and I know sometimes kids want to try, and the parents will be saying, no, I don't think you're going to like it. And then the kids try it, and they love it, It's like sometimes even, the parents are continuing the bad patterns, and it's a whole educational thing. It has to start really at the beginning. And I think you talk about it a lot with the kids. You got to start young with cooking and gardens and all that.
Yeah, and all those things are very, very important. I think that, the issues that I have with it is that it doesn't feel consistent. It feels ad hoc. It does, and things, it's like, for instance, if you're trying to teach somebody math, you don't all of a sudden do a spot math education program. You have, math education from, starting in pre-K. And, going all the way up every day, 180 days, a year, that's a school year, So it's the way, there's some systematic issues of nutrition education and food and how it's approached and, this ad hoc way. And then also there are other related, there's so many variables. For instance, variables that one might not think about. Do you have gas to cook with? Or are you living in NYCHA housing, and is your gas cut off? Or do you have to use a hot plate? Or do you have the right pots and pans? Right? Or mm-hmm. are there rats and mice running through and water bugs and roaches going through your apartment that make it unhealthy and cause asthma related issues? And you don't want to eat there. And also, is it more expensive to eat at home than it is to go out and go to a fast
food
restaurant
and feed,
and buy a Happy Meal? So, I think that there are so many variables out there that are, that are challenges. And I think that if we try to think of ways to, make these things simpler and think of, like, for instance, just like we talked about, circling back to the beginning about technology, being able to apply for SNAP on your phone in a short period of time. I mean, it should be a very quick application that you could put it on your phone and boom, it should be done.
Right, as opposed to spending a whole day down at the welfare agency.
Yeah, so I think that, you know, there are things that can be done that could expedite, you know, a better quality of life for people that are not, they're not overly complicated, but are made to be overly complicated because of a variety of reasons.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
I just
had a conversation with someone that did develop an application that was to make SNAP enrollment easier. And, you know, he was very polite to be politically correct about how he approached it. But, you know, my take on it, because I'm really not politically correct and say the wrong things all the time, but my take on it was that basically it was a slog to work with the government and all the agencies. And that's why he gave up, you know, where he's sort of reducing his efforts in that particular area. So, you know, those are the kinds of things that, to me, are disheartening.
You know,
we want to use technology to make things simpler. You know, for me, I still, you know, when I order from Peapod or Fresh Direct, I haven't used Amazon Fresh yet, but, you know, and I've used Instacart. I still feel like it's a miracle. And when the food comes, or I use Google Express,
uh-huh.
I still think and I go, wow, what an age I live in. This is unbelievable, you know, that I get to have this right to my house. It's incredible. So,
right.
You know, and so, I mean, I think that, you know, there's marvel in some of those things. And
right.
to make someone's life simple so that they could do other things like spend time with their family and help them with their homework or, you know, whatever it might be. Right, instead of sitting, you know, an hour and a half shopping and you know, or having to go to a fast food restaurant because that's a simpler, easier route.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a couple-minute break, and when we come back, I actually want to talk to you a little bit about your other hat, the diet detective, and hear about that a little bit. So everyone listening, don't go anywhere yet. I'm talking with Dr. Charles Plackin, and we'll be right back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green.
This is PRN.FM, your source for progressive radio that makes a difference.
Did you know Gaia has aligned with the Galactic Center? Our energies are rising from 3 to 5D, a transformation that integrates a new heart awareness and embodied ascension. I'm Catherine Davis. Please join me on Heart of Mind, radio for the new millennium, for conversations, insights, healing, and spirituality with love, peace, and compassion on Friday mornings, 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, and anytime. Listen or download on the PRN.FM archives.
Hi, I'm David Crow, host of The Infectious Myth that airs at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time here on PRN. I use data to deconstruct the myths that infect the modern world. Myths within health and medicine, other areas of science, the justice system, society, media, censorship, and politics. Join me for challenging interviews and discussions. Listen live, as a podcast, or by dialing 701-719-0990. Thanks for listening.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green, and I'm here with my guest, Dr. Charles Plackin, the director of the New York City Food Policy Center and also founder of the Diet Detective. Charles, you with me?
Of course I'm with you.
Great. So I just want, can you share with us a little bit about the Diet Detective? When did you start that, and what are some of the issues and topics that you really focus on or search?
Sure. You know, I started, I think, about 14 years ago. I thought I had a company called eFit that we were doing, you know, about 20 stories a day. We were a health and fitness network, online network. I had about 50 employees, journalists. And when the company we didn't get refund. We didn't get our funding. You know, we had gotten $3 million in funding, and then we, you know, it was sort of that internet bubble time. And the company, I had to, you know, sort of let most people go. And I had all this content. And I thought, oh, well, you know, I have this book, Breaking the Pattern, and I'm really interested in the health space. So I have all this content. I'll do a couple little rewrites. A lot of it I wrote. You know, I'll send it out to community newspapers for free. They're always looking for content. You know, this is back in 2000. And I sent out an email blast to some community newspapers, and I got like 100 responses. So I was like, what? Really? 100 people want this column? So, you know, I said that it was under a nonprofit grant because I wasn't going to charge for them. You know, charge them no commercial, you know, commercial funding or anything. So I said, well, you know, maybe I'll take a shot with daily newspapers also. So all of a sudden I had about, you know, 150 responses from daily newspapers wanting to carry the column either weekly or biweekly. So I said, wow, this will be easy because I already have a lot of the content. So it wasn't easy. It was a nightmare. I become incredibly responsible and felt it was really important. So every article, I didn't just take what I had. I completely redid them. I felt that they weren't even, you know, good enough for the quality that I wanted. And then this became my life. Writing these articles would take me 40 to 50 hours a week. Researching them. Getting interviews, getting calorie information, nutrition information, which was not available from anywhere. It was a tremendous amount of work, and now it doesn't take me much time. And also, I couldn't write, so it made it even more difficult. So I really had to, work, doubly hard. And the column, took off and had a lot of influence and was reaching millions and millions of people a week. And I took that very seriously. I wasn't making any money from it, but it still was very, it was ego gratifying, which was nice. And also the fact that I was making a difference. You know, when I would call, now people see calorie information and things like that, and nutritional information on websites, and they just think nothing of it. Well, I fought. And I was one of those people in the trenches fighting to get Starbucks and, yelling at the CEO and the head of communications, like, how dare you not be transparent? How, people should be able to know what's in their mocha latte, caramelata, whatever right, their names right. are. Right. So, I would, be fighting like an advocate, which, wasn't typical in the food space of having someone that was a lawyer and had an advocacy spin on what they were doing, kind of working in a journalistic space around food, right? So it was not normal having like an investigative reporter looking into food issues, and sort of fighting that good fight and exposing companies that were doing things that I thought were not right and synthesizing information that I thought people, who has 50 hours to figure out what's on a nutrition label, especially, right. 50 years ago, nobody. And I would sit there and do that and sort of crunch those numbers. And I found it very engaging and stressful, but I did it, and I did it each and every week. And, I was fortunate enough to be able to turn a lot of those articles and repurpose them and put them into books and expand on them. So I was lucky that I did find a home for them, to live on beyond just the newspapers that were publishing them and also online. And it also brought me, a lot of attention and publicity and, doing thousands and thousands of interviews on radio and television and in every different medium. And, I ended up getting a television show on WeTV from an NPR report that was done on me. It was called I Want to Save Your Life. It lasted a season, but it was where I would sort of help people to eat healthier and live better lives. Uh-huh. So there was an interesting time and place, and I still write the column And in fact, we just came out with an airline study that we do every year. And that was just, you know, released. It gets released in my column, but it also gets released to 10,000 other media outlets and gets picked up on all the morning shows and is, you know, it's very popular because I think airlines and, you know, we don't have a lot of choices when we're traveling in the air. It's not like we can get off the plane and go to another plane for, you know, for a meal that we like. We're sort of stuck in transportation. I don't want to say transportation hell, but, you know, it's not the best of environments sitting in a tube. It's like
it's
one big
not.
MRI.
Right, but, you know, at least you now can find in the little shops in the airplane or in the airports, you know, some healthier snacks. I mean, it used to be horrible. Now there's at least some organic snacks that you can find, but it's still pretty bad. I pack up a food bag anytime I'm traveling to bring with me because I don't want to depend on the meals, even the vegetarian meals. You know, I just don't know what they are. They're scary.
Right. It's not easy, but it's getting a lot better. Before, the airports were basically void of anything healthy and very expensive, too. And now there's definitely, because of demand, and because of, you know, shows like yours and columns like mine and things like that, food policy centers, they all help to contribute to getting that access for people, you know, that people might take for granted today. There was a lot of work and a lot of effort put into, you know, the food system movement in order to be able to have these things available for everybody that weren't necessarily available before. So, you know, there was a lot of groundwork that was done.
Sure. Now, there's a lot of talk lately and in the news about a whole food plant-based diet as being, you know, the best diet to reverse some chronic food-related diseases such as cancer, high blood pressure, diabetes. What are your feelings about that, the whole food plant-based diet? Do you advocate for that? Or,
you know, I think that, you know, one of the things that, you know, I teach a graduate course where I had for years the students that will go on and be registered dietitians. And one of the classes that I teach is about media confusion and how to, you know, deal with the, you know, the different diets that are out there and what is some common ground. Because even, you know, a plant-based diet, if it's sprayed with pesticides, is not a great diet, right? So, we, you know, there's a lot of thought that has to go into it. And everybody wants to be one and done and not think about their food on an individual case-by-case basis. And I think that's how food has to be looked at. You know, you can't be one and done. You have to be kind of a diet detective in your own life and think about, you know, each food, you know, on its own and how to approach it. So I think the research is mixed. You know, I think there's a lot of great research that Dean Ornish has done, and I can't believe the name escapes me. I interviewed him, the scientist from Cornell.
Colin Campbell?
Yes, right, exactly. So, and, you know, and he is very believable. And, you know, but then I listened to Gary Taubes, who I've interviewed, who is sort of the person that, you know, sort of is totally against, you know, sugar and carbs and so forth. And I listened to him, and I think he's a great scientific journalist and brilliant and has packaged his material well. And I think that he's not just trying to sell books. I think he's got a real mission. And they're both very compelling. If you read their interview, I have both of those interviews on dietdetective.com, and dietdetective.com is a free site. You'll see that, you know, they're both very compelling. So,
right, and then you listen to someone who's a promoter of paleo diet, eating all this meat and protein, and, you know, they can give you a good case also, I'm sure.
Yeah, they can give you, you know, I'm not as convinced of that case as the other two, but you know, I think that, you know, there's a lot to be said. Now, to me, if someone asks me, like, how can you go wrong with, you know, organic or vegetables? There's not a lot that can go wrong. Whereas the other, you know, everything else, there's suspicion that surrounds it. You know, other than, you know, with greens and things like that, the whole idea of pesticides is certainly concerning. So, I think there's a real place for plant-based diet, and it's probably, you know, anecdotally and instinctively, it probably is one of the best diets. But, you know, again, I it's hard to see. I think from a scientific point of view, nutritionally, we're in the very infancy stages of what we will eventually know. Right? I always play that clip from Woody Allen, Sleeper, where he wakes up and the two scientists are talking, you know, watching him outside, and they say, "Oh yeah, he still believes like that, you know, sprouts and so forth are healthy for you." He doesn't, and the other doctor says, "Really? He doesn't know that Twinkies are the best and healthiest thing for you?" So it was just a very funny twist of fate, you know. And if that clip's available online, it's just really interesting when you take a look at it, and you know, and realize that we're still very early in what we do know.
Right. It's true. Well, I want to just thank you so much for joining us. This has been really great, and I think the work you're doing at the New York City Food Policy Center is just so valuable, and I've attended many of the breakfasts, and whenever I can, I really enjoy coming, and I just want to thank you for being out there and sharing all of your knowledge with people and making it accessible so easily for everybody.
Thank you, and thanks for letting me be a guest on your show, and I appreciate it, and I appreciate all the hard work you do to get your messages out there.
Thank you. And everybody out there listening, thanks for joining us. You've been listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network, and I'll see you all again next week. Bye for now. Yeah.